The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you know where to send those comments. td@kpcg.fm. So much to get to on today's program. As per usual, there's just a lot happening in the world today. Today, of course, British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to be visiting the United States. She'll be addressing the Republican leaders in Philadelphia. I think President Trump's also going to be on hand. And then those two will be meeting together tomorrow in the White House. Ms. May is the first foreign leader to be invited into the White House. And so there has been plenty of commentary, especially coming from the right, suggesting that this is the beginning of an American and British resurgence modeled after the era of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Ms. May's speech, by the way, there's a transcript of it. I guess it's been released in advance, but evidently she's supposed to say something like this later on today in Philadelphia. As we rediscover our confidence together, as you renew your nation, just as we renew ours, we have the opportunity, indeed the responsibility, to renew the special relationship for this new age. That's what she plans to say. Today in the States, Theresa May, along with Republican leaders and Donald Trump. Later on, this transcript says, we have the opportunity to lead together again. The United States and Britain has the opportunity, she says, to lead together again. And then she talks about some of the glorious history. And of course, this is true. The leadership provided by our two countries through the special relationship has done more than win wars and overcome adversity. It made the modern world. The institutions upon which that world relies were so often conceived or inspired by our two nations working together. Indeed, the United States and Britain, these two, in so many ways, made the modern world. They did. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, talks a lot about that in the United States and Britain in prophecy. Why is it these two did so much together? How did they come upon such fabulous wealth and awesome power? And is it going to happen again? Well, actually, there is good news ahead. There is greatness ahead for the United States and Britain. But that comes after the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. There is no opportunity for these two. Before that event, that blessed event, there is no opportunity for these two to lead together again. It's some fascinating history discussed in the United States and Britain in prophecy, and more important still, is the prophecy that's discussed in that book. If you haven't studied it in a while, now would be a good time, because it's important amid all that's going on in the United States and Britain. It's important that we step back and understand the big picture. Here again, you can expect a lot of positive energy to come out of these meetings today between the U.S. and Britain, and tomorrow, as they look to nail down a U.K.-U.S. trade deal. And, of course, we've reported all through this week how Donald Trump he's not exactly a big fan of Europe or the European Union. And so he's reaching out to the U.K., and he's saying, you can forget about what President Obama said. You can hop right to the front of the queue. And here we are in the midst of these epic shifts in the global order. Of course, one thing where there is a great difference, you know what he said, Donald Trump, what he said about NATO being obsolete, and Theresa May evidently is going to try to help him see how important it is for America to lead the NATO group. In any event, though, all of this talk, all of this optimism, all of this positive energy, all of this hope that this is the beginning of something tremendous for both of these nations to lead the world again. Well, as I say, we do have to step back and view this. We have to see the history. And we have to understand the prophecy. That's what gives us insight into these events, and that's what helps us to see where it's leading. No other commentator works from this kind of advantage. My father wrote in the Ezekiel booklet, I read this just the other day. It's one of those paragraphs that he followed up with a statement saying, you need to go back and read that paragraph again. So I did, and have read it a few times since. But he says on page 71 of his booklet, when you forget your history, you lose your perspective, and you don't know what is happening. He said, if you're lost in the present, you can never cope with Satan's deceptions. Either we learn history, or we will repeat it. And that includes the history of this fallen cherub, speaking about Lucifer, of course, without context. Without context, you're just like Eve. You're making decisions based on whatever looks good. You're making decisions based on what looks good right in front of you. And that's why it's important for us to understand the context. My father even makes the point in Great Again that I think I read this to you yesterday, that Mr. Trump, President Trump, does a pretty good job of identifying some of the nation's problems. But are they going to be fixed? Are they going to be fixed? And is this new relationship, this special relationship between Donald Trump and Theresa May, is this the second coming of Reagan and Thatcher? Well, when you step back and look at some of these prophecies, these sobering prophecies of God, we've been talking a fair bit in recent programs about Jacob's trouble, the trouble coming on our nations, our people. Here again, this is what Herbert Armstrong had to say on that subject. This is clip number 3.
Now, there are remarkable prophecies of what is going to happen to the United States of America in these next few years. You're living here. You're going to live through these times. Now, we've been showing through the 30th and the 31st chapter of Jeremiah this terrible time of trouble that we're going to really get ourselves into, but we're going to be delivered out of it by the second coming of Christ.
The second coming of Christ, that's the solution. That's what we have to keep our minds on. But there are these remarkable prophecies preceding that return of Christ. Jacob's trouble. And we're living through these times. And you can see it from Jeremiah. You can see it from Isaiah, from Ezekiel. And Mr. Armstrong really did have a way of pounding that home again and again. This one here is from later in his life, another comment that he made about this time of trouble. This is clip number 4.
A time of trouble is coming, the great tribulation, such as never existed in the world until this time. Now, here is the same thing mentioned. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, greater than any trouble that ever came on the earth. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, and we are Jacob. That means the United States and Britain, when you understand where we're mentioned in the biblical prophecies, it's too bad that most people can't understand the Bible.
It's too bad that people can't understand it. It's too bad that people won't consider it. That they won't open their eyes to this truth. Who is Jacob? Who is Ephraim? Who is Manasseh? Who are these latter-day Israelites that are talked about in virtually every major prophecy in the Bible? It's talking about our nations. Another theme we've been repeating here of late is this law of cause and effect, blessings and cursings. There's a couple of verses over in Deuteronomy 5. I'll just read them for you. It's from the Moffat translation, but in Deuteronomy 5 and verse 32, it says, "Be mindful to do what the Eternal your God has ordered you. Always follow the straight road of life, which the Eternal your God has laid down before you, that you may live and that things may go well with you." I mean, always be mindful of the course that you're on, of the path that you're on. Follow the straight road of life. Jesus said it's the straight and narrow way. It's not the easy way, of course. But it says, follow the straight road of life, that things may go well with you. Now, has the United States, or Britain for that matter, have we been on the straight road of life? Are we mindful of doing what the Eternal our God has ordered us to do? Do we even care about what God says to do? And when you think on that for a moment, then consider where we are. Consider what has happened even in the last few years. Consider the damage that President Trump and Theresa May are trying to repair right now. I mean, there's a few statements here and there, or a few actions taken here and there, that sound like, well, hey, this is great. Maybe it's going to reverse it back. Reverse it back to what? There's a piece in the National Post. This was, I think, from last week, so it was right at the transition point from Barack Obama through to President Trump. And I'm sure there's plenty of people in the States right now that would prefer not to even talk about President Obama anymore. He's over. He's old news. And now it's a new day. We're building a wall, after all. We're going to be building a wall. There's been executive actions. It's going to roll back some of the punishment that Obamacare brought on us. Look at all these appointments. Look at these sharp individuals, these intellects, these great politicians. Forget about the old, in with the new. Look at the dizzying pace he's setting. Look at these first 5 or 6 days. A new day has dawned, they say. We have the opportunity to lead again, together with Britain, they say. And yet look at what the leaders in Israel are really and truly facing. This piece in the National Post, it's by Terry Glavin. It talks about all the euphoria in 2008 leading up to Barack Obama's landslide victory against John McCain. Draws attention in particular to the speech in Berlin back in July of that year, July 2008. 200,000 people showed up. It was like a rock concert. And it contrasts it with a stop John McCain made to New Hampshire at that same time that Barack Obama was landing in Berlin. And there was one reporter at the airport to greet John McCain. In the case of Barack Obama, I mean, people were going crazy in Europe, in the United States, everywhere. The whole world was in love with him. And he steamrolled his way into office, promising hope and change. And this piece says here, among the many millions of Obama's still entranced votaries, disciples, and admirers, all of whom are now quite sensibly aghast at what's looming in the imminent presidency of Donald Trump, you will not hear it said out loud, but the facts of it are unassailable. What was wrought by Obama's 2008 election was the beginning of the end of American power and prestige in the world. It was a good long 60-year run, but it's over. It's over. And, well, the point is made later. It's not like it was all Obama's fault. It certainly wasn't all George W. Bush's fault before him, even though the supporters of President Obama like to blame it all on Bush, and now so many of the supporters of Donald Trump. They want to blame all that's wrong in America on Barack Obama. But that said, I mean, there was a lot of damage done. And look at what the leaders in Israel are truly facing. It says, strictly speaking, it's not simply Obama's fault either, but wreckage is not a word that puts too fine a point on what has become of the American Republic. All of this wreckage, at home and abroad. And yet early on, he references the first speech given at the United Nations and all the people interrupting him 12 times to applaud him. The world was in love with him. The Nobel Peace Prize. He collected that around the same time as that first speech at the UN. A few months before that, it was the Cairo speech, the new beginning. He was going to change everything for the better. As far as U.S. Muslim relations go, he emphasized the common interests, the common principles that Americans had with Muslims. It was a new beginning. And yet, even within weeks of that speech, he just basically left those young Democrats in Iran that rose up. He left them hanging in the wind as the Ayatollah then cracked down on that resistance, crushed it. And then all the revolts right across the Middle East, 2010, 2011 in particular. And really nothing coming from the White House except for indifference. And then when there was a strong statement, like with Mubarak in Egypt, it was to run him out of town to give way to the Muslim Brotherhood. And then the deal, the Iran nuke deal with the mullahs. They say, okay, we'll delay it for a time. And America gives them all of this cash. Billions and billions of dollars. And, of course, basically a tacit agreement or tacitly agreeing not to get involved in Syria. Handing it over to Iran and Russia. This has all happened in the last 8 years. Another cost, it says, roughly 6 million refugees and mayhem sufficient to threaten the stability of the European Union. Another cost. After an almost total absence of 30 years, Russia has reemerged as a ruthless war criminal in the Middle East. At Obama's invitation. I mean, is Donald Trump going to fix all of this? Donald Trump's now working with Russia to go after radical Islam. That's how dramatic the transformation has been. I mean, the Middle East has been handed over to Russia. Russia's dominating the region. Obama's public relations specialist came up with a jingle about Syria becoming Russia's Vietnam. Instead, Russia's now the dominant global power between Istanbul and the Persian Gulf. And American credibility is shot. Is this going to be fixed? Does the United States reemerge in the Middle East? Well, Donald Trump has said it's been an absolute waste. 15, 16 years. And what have we gotten from it? We should have kept the oil, he says. But it was a mistake going in. It was a mistake. He's very proud of this, by the way. A statement he made along the way that if you decapitate Iraq, Iran's going to take over. He's very proud of having said that. We said it back in 1994 based on Bible prophecy. It's God who should be proud of all these prophecies. And yet he's laid it all out there for us so that we can see, so that we can know. It's too bad that most people can't understand the Bible. It's too bad that most people reject the one book that tells you what's coming in this administration. It's too bad, isn't it? We're so quick to place great faith in men, just like those 200,000 people in Germany back in 2008. Where are they today? What are they thinking today? Well, this article here continues. Obama's pivot to Asia, how'd that turn out? China's dominating the South China Sea, and now Japan's freaking out because China's moving into the East China Sea. They just keep moving. Same with Russia. The Philippines have absconded from the American sphere of influence into China's orbit. It says the Chinese regime is slowly tightening the noose around democratic Taiwan. After having only a bare-bones drawing board nuclear program when Obama came into office, North Korea has built up a stockpile of perhaps as many as 35 nuclear bombs. That was during the one presidency where, from the beginning, there was a determination to remove the nuclear weapons from this earth. And what actually happened? It says here, in an assessment for the Center for Policy Studies in London published this week, The Economist magazine's veteran correspondent and analyst Edward Lucas writes that after 30 years of covering European security, he has never been gloomier about the future of the United States. We need to prepare for a post-American, post-NATO European security order. That's what they're preparing for in Europe. I mean, it's accelerating now, given the statements that Donald Trump's been making. But this was moving forward during the years of President Obama as well. It's going to be messy, it says, costly and dangerous. And a lot of the blame falls on the shoulders of the man who just left the White House. But look, there's plenty of blame to go around. You go back to that verse, those two verses, Deuteronomy 5, be mindful to do what the Eternal your God has ordered you. Always follow the straight road of life, which the Eternal your God has laid down before you, that you may live, and that things may go well with you. I mean, that's what we all want, right? We want things to go well for us. We want things to improve. We want things to get better. But are we willing to do what the Eternal God has ordered us to do? I don't think so. And one administration's not going to fix all of these problems. It's a different world. It's a different world. Satan's been cast down. This article concludes here. That's not the sort of thing a great many of Obama's American admirers and Trump's most intelligent and forceful American adversaries will be happy to acknowledge, but it's something Canadians, this is a Canadian author, I guess, it's something that Canadians and just about everyone else in the world will have to reckon with. The American epic is over. It's over. It ended on Barack Obama's watch. I mean, it was a good 60-year run. It was fun while it lasted. But this is a new world. You think back to some of those covers of trumpet magazines. The end of Pax Americana. The end of America. Mark Stein wrote a book, I think, by that very title. In fact, he referred to this example over in Deuteronomy 5. Let's just look at that. study through this chapter briefly. Deuteronomy chapter 5. I mean, this is a passage that many just look at and suppose, well, this is a nice little child story. A hand writing on the wall and this great feast and this prophecy. I mean, if they don't say it's a children's story, they say, well, it's just history, if they even believe it happened. In fact, it's a prophecy. In fact, it's a warning for us today. It's a warning for our people today. As we noted the other day, one-third of the Bible is prophecy. And that's the very third that if people even bother to read any of the Bible, they neglect this third. The third where your headlines are recorded. The headlines in the news today. Tomorrow's news. It's been written in advance. It's laid out there for us in advance. Isn't it a shame that more people don't understand the Bible? It's too bad, as Mr. Armstrong said. It really is too bad. All of this prophecy, and it's for our time today. Verse 1 of Daniel 5 says, Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Here's Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, this great leader over Babylon, this kingdom. And he throws this riotous feast. You can read about it in the next few verses. And at the time, I mean, Babylon was Babylon. Babylon was a rock fortress. It was indestructible. That's what he thought. That's what the Babylonian people thought. Verse 5 says, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. I mean, this vision, this really frightened him. Here, right, just a few feet from him, he saw what appeared to be this huge human hand writing these letters. In the plaster, as it says, carving this message into the wall. Well, he yells out for the astrologers and the magicians of the land to come in and to give the meaning of this message, and they couldn't do it. And so Daniel was brought in. And the king said to Daniel, Can you tell me what this means? Verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be to yourself and give your rewards to another, yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. He wasn't in it to try to get any monetary gain out of it, but he did say, I'll make known the interpretation. Well, what was going on, even as they were feasting away? Well, even as they were feasting, Median and Persian soldiers were secretly entering into the city, preparing for the attack. Verse 18 says, O you king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up, and whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him, and he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he will. It's God who makes nations, And it's God who unmakes nations. That's the point here. That's what God was getting across to this king, this ruler. Verse 22 says, "And you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine in them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and brass, iron, wood, and stone, and see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways, have you not glorified?" The God in whose hand your breath is. That same God, the one Daniel describes here in chapter 5, that same God actually holds the very breath and life of our nations. We are in his hands. God is the one who makes and unmakes nations. And yet here we can assemble all of these intelligent human beings together, rulers, politicians, intellects, great men of business, commerce, and prop them up to preside over our nations, thinking that that will fix everything, thinking that we're great, we're a great rock fortress. But what does God say? What does God think? Notice what Herbert Armstrong said. This is from one of his older programs, clip 2.
"We think we're the strongest nation on earth. My friends, in less than 20 years, we're going to find there'll be a stronger power than we on this earth. It hasn't happened yet. You're living in terrifying times, and you probably don't realize it. You're just so interested in this apparent time of peace, and you like to get it out of your mind, and it's a time when we can have mechanical and material luxuries and gadgets and things, and we're so interested in those things. We're so self-centered in our own selves and other people and the things that our hands can make, in human interests, in television, in the new kind of movies that are coming out, in everything to amuse and entertain ourselves. We don't realize how empty our lives are either."
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his old programs. We think we're strong. We think we're doing great. We think now there's a resurgence, and don't realize the terrifying times that we're living in. Verse 30 here in Daniel 5 says, "In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain." In that night, "and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 80 years old. And so God, as he prophesied, God ended that world kingdom. As I say, God makes and unmakes nations. He makes and unmakes empires. God Almighty rules over the governments of men. Now, this is Satan's world, as we've said so many times before, but only because God allows it. God's about to remove Satan from the throne of this earth. But look at all these earth-shaking prophecies, sobering prophecies. Here's an example of God, the great creator God, bringing a world empire to its end. Herbert Armstrong wrote in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, "Do you think so great a fall could not come to so great powers as Britain and America?" He says you need to open your eyes to the fact that Britain's sun already has set. It's already happened to Britain. And the United States is fast riding to the greatest fall that ever befell any nation. That's what we need to open our eyes to. The handwriting's on the wall, Mr. Armstrong said. You can see it no matter the direction that you look in. And so in the last 5-6 days, I mean, you see some at least from a from a conservative standpoint, you see some positive steps taken against abortion or against Obamacare or announcing plans to secure the southern border, to build the wall. But keep in mind the big picture. Keep in mind the damage that's already been done. Keep in mind that the United States is fast riding to the greatest fall that ever befell any nation. Don't lose sight of that. And then also just scratch a little bit beneath the surface of so many of the positive declarations that are being made. President Trump last night on, I forget which network David Muir works for, NBC or CBS, I guess. But he asked him about the infrastructure plan. And, of course, Donald Trump has been out there saying, look, we've got to take all that wasted money, $6 trillion we wasted in the Middle East, and we've got to bring it home to Brooklyn, to Los Angeles, to Chicago. We've got to repair our bridges, our roads, our airports. And, well, that sounds great, but where's all the funding going to come from? $1 trillion in infrastructure development? And what happened to the $1 trillion infrastructure development that President Obama kicked off in 2011? I think follow-on studies to that show that 9% of that trillion, actually 9%, only 9% actually made it to infrastructure projects. The other 91%, well, it just gets lost in the bureaucracy. And so now it's another trillion. And we've got to do it. Well, we'll create all kinds of jobs. And then, as has been said, we're not even going to have to pay for it. It'll all be handled in the private sector. Promises, promises. This is, according to the Associated Press, some of the projects at the top of the White House's list. The expansion of New York's Second Avenue subway at a cost of $14 billion. That's going to create 16,000 jobs. So this is great. 16,000 people are going to go right to work. The reconstruction of the Northeast Corridor rail infrastructure between New York City and Newark, New Jersey, $12 billion. 15,000 new jobs. And then a high-speed Texas Central Railway to run between Houston and Dallas. America desperately needs a railway between Houston and Dallas. 240 miles long. $12 billion. 40,000 jobs. We've got to upgrade air traffic control. We've got to modernize the rail station in Washington, D.C., $8.7 billion for that. This is from the White House. Now, the Democrats have their proposal. Everybody wants to get in on this. Keep in mind, this is trillions. We're talking trillions of dollars. Another piece, Washington Post says advisors to Trump have said they would rely on federal tax credits and public-private partnerships rather than federal spending to pay for a new infrastructure program. So isn't that great? $1 trillion toward infrastructure projects, and it doesn't even rely on federal spending somehow. In fact, it does. In fact, Americans will foot the bill. And how much will be wasted away, just like it was in 2011. Notice what else the president had to say in that interview last night. This is clip six.
And you told the Washington Post that your plan to replace Obamacare will include insurance for everybody. That sounds an awful lot like universal coverage.
It's going to be what my plan is that I want to take care of everybody.
He's going to take care of everybody. This is just this is Barack Obama on steroids as far as social programs go. And at what point will the bubble burst? That's the thing. You know it's coming. Anyone with a brain knows it's coming. $20 trillion in debt. We've gone from 10 to 20 in 8 years. Where are we going to be 8 years from now? Where will we be 8 years from now? Just looking at the path that we're on and considering those verses, Deuteronomy 5, 32 and 33 we read earlier. Be mindful of what you do, what you don't do. We better pay attention to what God has ordered. Blessings and cursings. You go back to that passage in Daniel 5, the handwriting is on the wall. And anyone that doesn't think it could ever happen to the United States, anyone who thinks that needs to open their eyes to the fact that the sun's already set on the British Empire. I mean, forget about what God did to Babylon anciently. Look at what happened to the British Empire in the 20th century. And the United States is fast riding to the greatest fall that ever befell any nation. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program this week. You can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. An exciting, pulsating, vital third of all the Bible is devoted to prophecy. And approximately 90% of all prophecy pertains to our time, now, in this 21st century. It is a warning to us, to our English-speaking peoples, of immediate life and death import. The prophecies come alive once their doors are opened by this now-discovered master key. The United States and Britain in prophecy will open, to open minds, this hitherto closed vital third of all the Bible. No story of fiction ever was so strange, so fascinating, so absorbing, so packed with interest and suspense as this gripping story of our identity and our ancestry. Request the United States and Britain in Prophecy and a free one-year subscription to the Trumpet magazine right now. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
But I want to tell you, my friends, our nation is guilty and stands guilty before God. The handwriting is on the wall of America now. The United States of America is being weighed in the balances by God Almighty and found wanting. And it's time for us to wake up.
It is time. It's time for us to wake up. That's Herbert Armstrong, of course, talking about that same prophecy we reviewed there in the first segment. You look at what's happening. Not just in the United States and Britain, but as we've also been covering this week, the impact the Trump presidency is having on Europe. And what they're now saying in Europe. There was a piece in the Financial Times just the other day, yesterday or the day before, by Emmanuel Macron. I probably mispronounced that. He's a candidate for the French presidency. But this is him writing in the Financial Times saying the vote in the UK to leave the EU should be seen as a warning shot by those who take the European project seriously. So Brexit, that was an earth-shaking development just months ago. It says it did not just reflect the depth of British Euroscepticism. It also held up a mirror to the EU, reflecting a dysfunctional and highly uninspiring organization. So it's exposed flaws in the EU, in the European Union. And then Donald Trump comes along and he's criticizing it as well. More people should leave. More people should break away. More nations. And this candidate for the French presidency says here, we must rebuild Europe's institutional and democratic foundations and ensure that any new EU-wide powers are understood and accepted by its citizens. So it's not like, let's do away with it. Let's all just leave and go our separate ways. But we do need to rebuild it. You talk about an infrastructure program. That's what's coming in Europe. It needs to be rebuilt. At the same time, he writes, we must defend and strengthen a union that allows European countries to speak with a louder voice on the world stage. Mr. Trump's recent critical remarks about the EU highlight how important this is. So, I mean, we've got to be more muscular. We've got to be stronger. We've got to have a louder voice. As we consider this rebuilding project, Europe faces a choice. It says it's confronted by the refugee crisis and an unprecedented terrorist threat. Until now, the idea of a common European defense policy has raised eyebrows. And it talks about when efforts have been made in the past to get this moving. It's always failed. This European defense policy. Today, it says Europe faces multiple enemies while the alliance is uncertain. Well, let me just back up to get this thought before that. In 1954, when the European defense community failed, Europe had a common enemy and through NATO, a strong ally. The common enemy, of course, was the Soviet Union, and the strong ally was the United States. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, that alliance held even though the enemy had disappeared. Today, however, Europe faces multiple enemies while the alliance is uncertain. So now there's enemies from every direction, but the alliance with the United States is shaky. What did Mr. Armstrong say? We better open our eyes to realize what's happening here. We better open our eyes to see what's going on. The alliance is shaky. We cannot fail again, this man writes. We must create a European defense fund with a permanent headquarters in charge of operation planning and monitoring. This is an op-ed piece in the Financial Times. A leading voice in France. He says central to this is the Franco-German relationship. It's got to be strong. I mean, that's the center. That's the base of a strong, united Europe. After the Second World War, Europe and the U.S. worked together to rebuild a shattered continent, eventually giving birth to the EU. They did so in order to defend liberal democracy against communism and totalitarianism. And they did so in the fight against terrorism. This is a precious legacy, he concludes. This is a precious legacy, but now, we Europeans are on our own. See, now Europe is on its own. Big Brother in the United States is leaving. Oh, they're reaching out to Britain. They're thinking it's a 1980s redux, but Europe is on its own. Even as Britain leaves. Even as the United States says, we're not carrying other people's burdens any longer. It's over. He says here at the end, we can close our eyes and pretend we still live in the world of yesterday. We can keep on bickering, mesmerized by the lure of an illusory sovereignty. Or we can decide to act together and shape our own future. Well, some of them are going to act together and shape their future. Pretty dramatic events happening right now. Every day. There's another piece from the New Yorker about just all these populist movements that are gaining in strength and that now feel like momentum is on their side. And here again, it's not like these two forces oppose each other entirely. the one argument from the French leader who wants to be president and who wants to rebuild the Union. And then those who want more sovereignty, national sovereignty, the nationalist populist movements. This particular piece, the author writing in The New Yorker was in Koblenz over the weekend. That's where they had the far-right groups in Europe meeting. We mentioned that, I think, earlier this week. But she's sitting down at a coffee shop with one of the attendees from that that meeting. And he said the reality today that European countries are interdependent is clear to everyone, he told me. Cooperation is obvious, but it's a question of what kind of cooperation. The one we have now, which benefits the economic empire and denies identity in submission to globalized interests, is that what we want, that kind of cooperation? Or is there another arrangement that might work? He said, Europeans share a cultural heritage. We have our Roman roots, our language, our culture, the cathedrals you see, whether in Cologne or Paris, that are Gothic, that's transnational. The Renaissance was a European phenomenon, and the greatest religious moments that marked Europe, the spread of Christianity, the Reformation, those were never isolated to one nation. And so there are some strong common interests in these many different nations. But what is he getting at there? What is that unifying force? What is the strongest unifying force in Europe? It's religion. It's Rome. It's the Roman Empire. It's that history. That's what he's saying. And that's someone that's attending this meeting in Koblenz on Saturday. All these different far-right groups in Europe coming together, thinking now momentum's on their side after Brexit, after Donald Trump. Europe's being rebuilt. It's being refashioned. And it's happening all the more so and a lot faster now that they realize they're on their own. They're now on their own. All right, I'll conclude here with a few emails. And forego the chance to take another quick break with the promo since we're just about out of time. Got about 3 minutes here, and hopefully I can get through three or four of these. It says here, firstly, this is a general response to the program, and a good one at that. My son's letter is a little sloppy. She's got a 10-year-old who's written me once before. I read it over the air, and he was nice enough to write another one. She says, my son's letter is a little sloppy and hard to see, so I will type it out here. He likes to get a little poetic, and like his mother, we can't seem to help ourselves from run-on sentences. This is what her son had to say. I'm trying to repent and be humble, and thank you for helping me and being strong. You inspire me to get molded by God, to be as strong as you, and be part of God's family, and overcome fear and hate, and do my best. I will never stop trying because of you, and I'll always love God. But I also would like to thank my mom, who is like a bird feeding her kids and giving them a home and eternal life. That's a wonderful, wonderful response. Message coming from a 10-year-old boy living there with his mother in the state of New York. Another one here, a little lighter. This is from also one of our female listeners. She says, as wonderful as it is that some people would like the program to be increased to 2 hours, I am in the 1 hour only camp. So here's an honest listener. An honest listener speaking her heart. It says, for one, it would be a lot of work for you to put together a 2 hour program every week, every day, I guess. For another, it would deter some listeners from even beginning because they may not have 2 hours available to listen. But also, there are plenty of positive ways these listeners can fill their second hour after listening to your program. They could review a past program that ties in with the current one. They can listen to one of the other programs from KPCG. They could dig into the literature offered in the broadcast. You could plug some extra curricular material for these people to get into. They could take on a new hobby or devote themselves to learning a new skill or some type of volunteer project, more prayer, etc. If I were to request something from KPCG, it would be a program devoted to teaching history. Radio is a great tool to broadly distribute that type of education. So some excellent feedback there from one of our regular listeners. She writes in quite often. One last one here says, your programs on biblical prophecy are spot on as recorded in the Bible. I learned so much. There's so much truth to process every day. It's some very strong meat for us to digest as we go along in our daily battles. You and your staff are much loved. I try to keep everyone there at Edstone in my daily prayers. Also, thank you for playing great music for all of us that listen to the program every day. So that's some feedback from some of you. And if you'd like to send in some comments, you can do that. I'll let you do it. Just send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow.